A dramatic police chase ends with a car chasing onto a platform at Auckland's Middlemore train station. The Justice Minister, Andrew Little, prepares to introduce new counter-terrorism laws to deal with the potential return of foreign fighters from Syria. Charities around the country see a growing demand for food as people on limited incomes struggle to make ends meet. And the cancer care advocate Blair Vining, described as an absolute legend and selfless hero, has the final say at his memorial service. Those are the headlines. No traffic problems to report, so to tonight's weather. Fine spells, isolated showers for most of the country, but heavy and possibly thundery rain in Gisborne and Hawke's Bay. Showers at the Chatham Islands. You're listening to The Panel with Wallace Chapman on RNZ National, 28 minutes to 5 now.
What a tune that is. What a tune. Anybody put their hand up? Who knows it? Text me 2101. Silence here. It's no, famous.
Yeah.
Come on.
Captain Kangaroo.
No.
Dog show.
Yes.
Yes.
A dog show.
Yes.
The forerunner of slow TV. It was that boring. All right, so what is your favourite New Zealand television show and why in the past, present, or maybe future? Before we go to our audience around the panel, I said Backchat. Actually, I've had an astonishing email from my senior producer, Caitlin Cherry, who said I was a reporter on Backchat, which was an arts policy-based show fronted by Bill Ross on a Sunday morning. Never missed a nip. I loved it. Sowen Manning, what about you?
Telethon.
Telethon?
Telethon. I loved it.
They were amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any moment that sticks out?
I remember a particular crook in South Auckland that seemed to get a lot of, you know, donations going his way, and everyone locally was saying, I bet that didn't make the TV studios. That's one of the more memorable ones. But, you know, going right back, you know, if you think when we were all very, very young, probably some of us perhaps too young to remember, and there was Chips on TV. And Eric Estrada was over.
Huge fan.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the international stars that used to come for telethon were huge.
And then
they?
There was Entertainment That Week with that dude
Lisa
from
Gibbons.
Lisa Gibbons. She came
with
over.
Coronation Street dude. And they kind of struck up a romance or something.
Yeah, the guy with the blonde hair from Coronation Street and Lisa Gibbons. That's right.
What's but his name?
I remember that. What was his name? Oh, I can't remember.
Somewhere. He was Gail's son or something, wasn't he?
Yeah.
You know, on COVID, burned
I
into
remember.
The brain cells. You couldn't
I think
watch
I was. I must have been working at TVNZ. At the time.
Okay, so you, it was telethon. Yeah. Telethon shines a light. For me, it's Backchat. What about you?
Okay, so you said to us, what's your favourite show and why? Hmm. So, again, in about 1911, I was the general manager of TVNZ Enterprises. Now, TVNZ Enterprises was a division which was meant to make more revenue out of the programming that they'd already sunk the money in. I mean, what a good idea. We did, I'll have you know, the first sell-through video, which was called The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. However, we also did a Gloss range of cosmetics.
You didn't.
And we did, and I loved Gloss. It was a fantastic show. And actually,
it wasn't really though, was it?
No, it was. That's
it wasn't
the thing.
Really though, was it?
Yeah, no, it was. It was a really no. It
no,
was.
No, be honest.
No, it was. And they look. It had a huge audience. It had a really good storyline.
Oh,
good
come
acting.
On.
Oh no, look, it was. The beginning of really good, I thought, drama. So now what happened was we got this Australian programmer over because TVNZ was in absolute fear. Oh, my God, TV3 is going to destroy them. Ron, someone or other. And anyway, he did the cultural cringe, took one look at it, canned Gloss. And you know what I had? I had a warehouse full of Gloss lipsticks. I had won the right. We'd copyrighted the name Gloss. We had lipsticks and nail polishes.
Where are they now?
I don't know. I went up to Julian Mounter and I said, I can tell Enterprises is not important. And he said, yep, you're right. Her Gloss is gone.
You should Sinos to Papa.
No, look, I thought, yeah, God knows what happened. And we actually had to go to court. Julian Miles, remember, you know, fantastic barrister, he represented us in court because there was some other little makeup manufacturer that thought this is a good idea, and they started making gloss lipstick as well. Oh, no, no,
this
no.
This is incredible TV stories. Yeah. Okay, so...
So that's my favourite show, Gloss.
Wonderful. What an interesting story. All right, Wallace, there was a New Zealand detective program called Duggan, D-U-G-G-A-N. It was really good, set from memory in the Marlborough Sounds. Good stories, very picturesque. Someone says, Terry Teo and the Gunrunners. Amazing because it got me into being a skateboarder. Wonderful. John Gordon's The Dog Show. Always fun, often hilarious, and quintessentially New Zealand, says Robin of Sefton. Married at First Sight is rubbish, but 7 Days is probably the only show our family, including two teens, watches every week.
Wow, that's good, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Gliding On, because it's so funny, so Kiwi. The stereotypes were so true that it almost made it a documentary of the public service. 7 Periods with Mr. Gormsby, a disturbingly accurate preparation for my 8-year sentence in a South Auckland high school, someone says. The Brokenwood Mysteries, a few say Wellington Paranormal. Penny Ashton, who is a panellist, says, quit your whining, Wallace. Where is that? It's been lost in the volume.
Good on you, Penny. Yeah.
Quit your whining, Wallace. Gloss was awesome.
Yeah.
I was so sad when it was cancelled.
By an Australian.
Right, okay. Fair enough.
What about Havoc and Newsboy?
Brilliant.
They were brilliant.
Wouldn't miss it. Yeah. I wouldn't miss it. Exceptional TV. Justine says, loved It's in the Bag with Selwyn Toogood. Edge of your seat stuff. Imagine winning a fridge.
I had a lifetime of being called Selwyn Toogood.
Did you?
I did, while he was
Just a few more. I'm a big fan of Police 10-7. It shows all that is good and bad in New Zealand in one episode. I was also a fan of this political show where members of Parliament were interviewed in front of a live audience from inside a pub. Yes, that's a show that I did. It's called Backbenchers. Hmm. Funny Business, New Zealand Comedy with Chris Knox, animations. Yes, very good show. Favourite TV show, Terry and the Gunrunners, 1980s version, starring Billy T, Michael Benteen, and Sue
Rodgers. That was really
Muldoon.
Good. Yeah.
These are fantastic. And just a couple more. Has to be Eating Media Lunch, just because it was the best. And in TV, consistency is the key. So thank you very much for your huge responses this afternoon.
What a rich history.
Yeah. What, haven't we?
Isn't that fantastic? You know, all of those shows, you know, that you just named, are fantastic. You know, we really have got a lot of talent. We can take it to the world.
And long may it continue.
Yes.
Mm. Another one I've got to mention, because just looking at the very, very recent ones, one show that I absolutely love, it is a diamond in local content, and that is a show called The Casketeers. I don't know if you've watched
it. I've seen this. I've seen the shorts.
It is
The Funeral Guy.
Yeah.
Yes, it's on Netflix now.
Yeah.
It is 5 stars.
I was in Aussie last week, and someone over there must have been watching it. They were talking about it, you know, and just saying how cool it was. And,
it's actually real, isn't it? But it's a reality show, but it views like a comedy.
It's the sensitivity of the people involved. You know, I just thought it was
beautifully
tops.
Done. Yeah. It's beautifully done. It's 20 to 5. You're on the panel with me today, recruitment specialist Cindy Michener and journalist Sarah Manning. Changing tack now, reading an article by RNZ's Sarah Robson laying out the issue of those on benefits struggling with ever-rising living costs. Nearly $550 million is owed to the MSD for recoverable hardship assistance and grants. That up more than $100 million from 4 years ago. The grants can be used to pay for things like bond, rent car repairs, uniforms, whiteware, etc. The government is being told by those working in the sector that too many people are now trapped in a cycle of debt, and that the government needs to be more willing to write off debts run up for basic living costs. Now, in May of this year, the Welfare Expert Advisory Report was released, which contained 42 recommendations for overhauling the welfare system. 3 were picked up on. Implementing all of them would have a $5 billion price tag to go along with it. So, Cindy, you first. Writing off debts, that would be a big call, would it not?
Well, it would be a big call, but, you know, just looking at it, it's not writing off laziness, bad behaviour, or profligate spending. they haven't been given the loan without some sort of research or acceptance that there is a real need. And the real need is, you know, about food or about shelter. It's a core need. I mean, you know, the criticism of the welfare system, you know, which I don't agree with, but the criticism of the welfare system is, oh, well, you know, they haven't had a job, they're sponging, they're this, that and the other thing. I don't think this is that. This is absolutely about families, usually mothers, solo mothers with kids that cannot afford to live the grants.
So you're not a believer in welfare, and yet you believe in racking up debt?
No, I am a believer in welfare for those that need it. And the definition of need is what's important. And
a tight safety net.
Yeah, well, the point about these debts is they should be written up off because they were not given for any reason that normal people expect the right to be able to eat, to be warm, etc. This is New Zealand. It's not, you know, the hood somewhere. So I don't think we should be able to just, you know, be giving away the welfare without some accountability. In this particular instance, it is very accountable and the debt right. should be written
okay,
off.
OK, so we've got a guest on this very, very shortly, but Sawin, so you've got, what's the issue here? You've got nearly, well, actually, over $500 million owed to the MSD for recoverable grants, $100 million more than owed to MSD 4 years ago. So something's going awry here, people not meeting their bills and need help?
Look, I see figures like this very clearly. It's an litmus test of the cost of living for those that have been dispossessed of opportunity and reaching potential. If we take a social equity approach to this whole thing, writing off the debt, yep, I think in a broad sense, in general terms, yes. But we can do it through all sorts of different ways. How about incentives, for example? If the person who's racked up with these debts because they haven't been able to afford the basics, they tick off a particular criteria there relating to reducing debt. If they've got a mark here, they've gone to budgeting services. If they've been taking up the opportunities for reintroducing or transition to the workplace, you get what I'm getting at here.
Yeah,
I could list a dozen if you like.
More of an incentivising.
And those are social equity measures of which is what is the backbone of this country's successes, if you like. When I graduated first from journalism school, I was on the dole for a while after that. You know, who out there hasn't had some sort of assistance by the state until you're at a point where you can enter into your ambition and in some ways reach your potential? This rack of debt is a complex issue. Everybody's situation will be different. But I think there's groups like CPAG and others out there that are coming through with good practical solutions. We've got a government that campaigned on a goodwill measure of trying to actually resolve poverty in this country. There is a momentum to it, albeit slow. Incrementalism. Let's see some real rungs on the board, particularly because we got a 7.5 billion dollar surplus
There's
last
that big
week.
Cushion.
Even with the Kiwi Rail kind of a component taken off, okay. It's a massive gain.
All right. Well, with us is Chief Executive of Lifeways, Moira Lawler. Moira, welcome to the panel.
Oh, kia ora, Wallace.
Yeah, kia ora. So you say that beneficiaries should be able to work more hours without being punished. So this is the abatement threshold, and this is quite a sticking point for many, is it?
I think so. I mean, the starting point, I couldn't agree more with your panellists, is that people are trying to survive on benefits that push them below the poverty line. So, as you said, the government invested in a welfare advisory group. They came up with a very reputable report that essentially said you have to increase main benefits, you have to remove sanctions, and you have to increase abatement thresholds. And you know, we can talk about all of the kind of the pieces of the puzzle, but essentially people don't have enough to live on. And so part of what we see is not only are people expected to live on an unlivable amount of money, like a single person on a job seeker, roughly $215 a week after tax, that's what they're living on. Then they pay rent, then they pay power, then if they have a phone, they buy a phone card, then they pay water, because, of course, in Auckland, that's separate. You know, it doesn't take much for you to end up with $20 that you're trying to buy your groceries with.
Right.
And that's without any kind of life event that most of us have with regular intervals that might require a bit more money than you plan.
Yeah, we've talked about this before on the show, and, you know, someone said very passionately, you know, her clients have, what, $70 a week to deal with food, you know, so you're really...
It's just not enough.
No, and the point was that the money going out is more than the money coming in. But let me ask you something, Maura. So this abatement threshold we're talking about, now for those on job seeker support, it will increase from $80 to $90 next year and another $5 each year until it reaches $105 in 2023. Surely that's a good thing.
Well, it's a good thing. And with respect to this government, I also think it's a giant snow job. I mean, the whole point of the abatement rate, when it was set in the 80s, and it has not been adjusted for a very long time, it was set to represent 2 days' work. So the concept was, if you're on a benefit, you should be able to work something like 15 hours a week before your benefit was cut. And so 2 days a week of work, even at the minimum wage, is now worth a lot more than $80. So all that happens is that, you know, some people get on and do that because for them, you know, the opportunity to contribute, the opportunity to participate is worth it. But most people end up worse off. And even, I guess, for people who have spent a long time engaging with WINS, there's also, quite frankly, the fear of going into WINS, of explaining that your circumstances changed, of hoping that they'll get it right, that you'll be abated at the right level, that you won't get someone who messes up your entitlement. We've had people stood down when they've gone in to talk about the fact that they're now earning a few dollars a week and, you know, they're self-disclosing this so that the abatement has got right. And again, it comes back to people who live in poverty, like the terror of going in to get some money out of the bank and discovering that actually your benefit's been cut and now you've got nothing is just too much. So people are not prepared to do anything that puts at risk their very meagre income. So we have all of the wrong incentives, I guess, in the wrong place.
All right, so just looking back to that May report, that those 42 recommendations, what were the three committed to? There was the end to sanctions on sole parents, two, changes to the abatement, three, the additional frontline staff. But then you had that biggie. The biggie was restore the benefit levels back to what it was in the early 90s. So that would be, what, a 47% increase. So you're suggesting somewhere along the line...
Prior to 91?
Prior to 91, rather.
Right, yeah.
So CPI...
Yeah, that's
increased
right.
...increased from... Yeah.
Yes, so you're saying more, or you're suggesting more, that's the big recommendation, that somewhere along the line kind of has to be addressed.
It absolutely has to be addressed. And, you know, all of this talk about debt to WINS, let's remember what
crazy.
That is. This is somebody going in and saying, the school term's about to start and my children have no school uniforms, and WINS acknowledging that that's a reasonable expense for a family and providing funding for that school uniform, but then expecting the family to pay that back by docking their benefits until that debt is paid. Like, if the family's in hardship, they're in hardship. Why should they have to have that as a debt? It's crazy.
Yeah. What about this? What about an incentive scheme to write down people's debt as they move off the benefit? So you'd have that debt still. Once you get back into work, then you start paying it back.
I think that's a good idea. I mean, I would say any debt that is a WINS debt that you've received through hardship. I mean, for example, we house people who are long-term homeless. They move into a house in order to get a fridge. WINS will front the cost of the whiteware, but only if they pay it back out of their benefit. I'm sorry, I couldn't live without a fridge. I don't think a fridge is a luxury item. So in my view, if it's a hardship grant given to a person by WINS in order to meet their living costs, they should be waived. They shouldn't be debts at all. They should come to them as part of their benefit.
Maura Lawler, Chief Executive of LifeWise, thank you very much for joining us on that one. It's 10 to 5. I have quite a bit of response on that, but we want to move on to this because this is really interesting. It was a fascinating piece. Phil Pennington discussing this issue with Joy Cowley this morning. Beloved and best-selling children's author of Joy Cowley has defended a Palmerston North bishop who resigned after an investigation found him to have been sexually inappropriate towards a young woman. Bishop Charles Drennan was believed to have been involved in a sexual relationship with the woman, which Miss Cowley says would have made him a better bishop. She also believes most Catholic priests do have sex and hopes the case pushes the Vatican towards scrapping mandatory celibacy. So we're going to speak to an expert on religions and their practices, Dr. Peter Lynham, but shortly first to the panel. What's your thoughts on this story? Are you surprised by Joy Cowley's defence, Cindy, of the bishop and almost what some may see as victim blaming in the situation?
As we were talking about before, Joy Cowley is sort of quite involved with Catholic Church, isn't she? And she may have been a little bit blindsided by it all. But, I mean, you know, when she says, you know, do they think that a vow of celibacy guarantees immunity? Well, the answer is yes. You know, I mean, the vow of celibacy, is it relevant? Probably not. But, you know, to be honest, I don't see how Joy Cowley can say it makes him a better person. I think the level of hypocrisy involved once you have taken the vow of celibacy actually shines a light on perhaps a, you know, your personality a bit, because if you were, you know, I'm not saying that I think they should be celibate. I think mm-hmm. they should be able to be part of the normal situation. But at the moment, you're meant to be, and people should be able to respect and, or not respect, but they should be able to trust that, as particularly young women. I think it says a lot more about a slightly darker side of a personality of the bishop, the fact that, you know, he lived a bit of a double life.
Selwyn?
Yeah, I look at this and I think that hypocrisy is the word that Cindy used, and I think that's very appropriate. The hypocrisy of celibacy. And you look at that.
The hypocrisy of celibacy?
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean it's a complete
pretending.
The pretense around it, the mystique, the mystery, the tradition. Where's the spirituality within that? So this is the big issue, isn't it? And it gets right back to the Vatican. And look, I'm not Catholic, so in a way it's an observer's kind of point of view. But I think that is the biggest stumbling block of getting to grips as to trying to find the reason around that question, why? In all of the ways this problem is expressed. And if you look at this particular situation, Joy Cowley might be absolutely right. She knows the person that's in the spotlight on this particular issue. She obviously has got a strong regard for him. But in some ways, when you have that kind of relationship with a person who's in the spotlight, it can actually alter your perceptions of things relating to the other side, meaning the victim, et cetera, if there is a victim situation in this case. The hypocrisy of celibacy. You know, other churches and other religions do not necessarily have to have such a strong doctrine. Is doctrine the word?
Doctrine, yeah. Attach it to the spirit. So attaching celibacy to spirituality is not needed in other religions. Well, let's bring in our expert who can explain it perhaps better than us. Dr. Peter Lynham, just retired from Massey University at the end of last year, who is a religious historian, and he's extensively looked into New Zealand's religious past. Kia ora, Peter. Good to have you on the panel.
It's a pleasure.
So, look, let's talk about this enduring mandatory Catholic celibacy and the vows. What is the idea behind it?
Okay, so it is linked to the growing emphasis on the Eucharist that came in the Catholic Church in the 10th century. By no means is it doctrinal. That's quite important to understand. That in fact it's simply a discipline adopted for priests because they were handling the purity and the exalted character of the Eucharist once the belief in transubstantiation had been accepted. So that was the view that this really was the very body and blood of Christ, and therefore it would defile the person if they were also involved in a marriage. But there are in fact lots of cases of exceptions. For example, recently the Catholic Church has permitted High Anglicans who've decided that they want to be Catholics to transfer as priests into the Catholic Church, and they come with come with wives. Mm. So there's no doctrinal reason why it can't happen. It's just tradition. It's a long tradition, though.
Oh, that is very, very interesting. So, look, might taking this vow make the Catholic clergy, I don't know, more susceptible to inappropriate sexual behaviour than perhaps other religious orders? Can we make that link or not at all?
I think we can partly make that link. I mean, it's fair to comment that most priests actually make the choice to enter the priesthood really very young compared to most Protestant denominations. They'll typically enter in their late teens and start a 7-year training. And so, I mean, there's a lot they don't actually know about themselves, I think, at that point. And of course, it's easy to have a very high view of the calling that you have and to put aside natural urges that you've got for a while, but those natural urges don't go away. Mm. So I think it's fair to say that any priest committed to celibacy is going to have some challenges at points. But, of course, remember that those people who are priests in other denominations, they're not free from slip-ups and infidelity. That certainly happens.
Dr. Peter Lynham, thank you very, very much for your time. How interesting is that?
I think that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. It sort of doesn't excuse, in my opinion, you know, I mean, I think the quote is, Joy said, I'm sorry for the woman concerned, but I have seen how young women flirt with priests. Do they think that a vow of celibacy guarantees immunity? I mean, that sort of harks back to that, oh, well, you shouldn't be wearing a skirt that short. And, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't think that they're appropriate remarks.
And it may, you know, let's be frank, it might be just a young person's response to an authority figure. I don't mean flirting. It might be expressed in a way of respect. Who knows? You know, those kind of things are pretty difficult to tie down.
And on a fairly brief note, rounding out the show, how do you feel about someone doing a little DIY on your street in an effort to make it safer? So Sarah spent $300 on cat's eyes to create a rumble strip before a stop sign at the intersection. Liquid nails used to attach 35 cat's eyes, which were installed illegally. She wanted to make her hood safer. Is it something that you do in your own street, Selwyn? Or
I suppose sleepless nights, hearing cars screaming down, doing wheelies and things like that gets you to do things that are more extreme, doesn't it? You know, and particularly if your local government isn't going to be doing its
takes
job.
Takes ages.
Yes, doing the
good
job.
Good honour.
Yeah.
Good honour, absolutely. You know, get up there and fix it yourself. Why not?
Think of, do I need a judder bar? Can I call the council? Let's do it myself.
Yes,
I can see
right.
The wheelbarrow now while a Saturday morning job.
Call Sarah.
Well, you're not on Sundays now. You can be your Sunday.
That's right.
Yeah. Anarchy.
Jennifer, here we come. Sydney Mitchell, Sarah Manning, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
On today's panel. Wonderful.
Lovely to be here.